Okay, what do we have next?
It's paper 11. That's Icelandic employee benefits.
Paper 11. John, take it away.
Thank you, Wayne. We are presenting three papers to the committee at this meeting relating to work we are doing towards the re-exposure of D9. And these papers are 11A, which is a common data analysis of D9, paper 11B, which is a high-level common data summary of the 2008 discussion paper on employee benefits by the IASB, and 11C, which is on scope and measurement of D9. The staff plan is to bring proposals on measurement of D9 plans to the committee in September, with a view of bringing a revised draft of the interpretation to the committee in November. If we go to paper 11A, which is a comment letters analysis of the responses we received to D9 in 2004, and there was a general support for the use of defined benefit accounting for the plans that would fall within the scope of D9. The main matters that were raised in the comment letters were on the scope of D9 and the measurement approach. And we get back to these topics when we discuss paper 11C. Paper 1B is a high-level summary of the discussion paper which the board issued in 2008. One of the proposals in that discussion paper was a new definition of contribution-based promises, which would include what was previously considered defined contribution plan, which is a much wider definition than the one used in D9. Many respondents to the discussion paper, especially on contribution-based promises, were critical of the proposals, and after considering the responses, the board decided to split the project on post-employment benefits into two parts, with contribution-based promises in the second part and potentially as a part of a comprehensive review of pension accounting. And the board did therefore not do any further work on contribution-based promises at that point. Now, do committee members have any questions on those two papers?
I like the general direction that we're heading there, because I think that was also what we agreed on last time, that we're looking at D9 again and as it is. However, I think it would be worthwhile, as you bring this back in the September meeting, to a question: do you intend to have some outreach to the companies or whoever as to how they are applying the, if and how they are applying D9 now? Because I know that a number of companies apply D9, no matter if it's in place or not. So we should have some view on that if people are applying it.
Yeah, we are doing outreach and have been doing outreach on those issues, and we need to do more on that. We have had some confirmation of the use of D9. It's or the approach in D9. We are not certain to how widespread it is up to this point, and whether it's used on only the most simple plans or whether it's used on the more complicated plans, but that's something that we are working on.
So the outreach there is to ask people about the plans that they're that they think might fall within the scope of what we're looking at, contribution-based promises, and to ask them how it is that they're accounting for these plans, so that we can get a better feel for what's happening in practice at the moment. Because we are aware that in some places the proposals that were in D9 are being applied. And so what would be interesting, I think, is to find out how widely the proposals in D9 are currently being used in practice.
I think Bert's question is, when you say ask people, who are the people?
Well, the outreach that we've already done is to go through the national standard status. We've contacted the members of the, which were part of the employee benefit working group, and the regulators, which is the usual outreach groups
good.
That we use.
Good.
We use the regular channels. And we do it by IFRIC update to ask a broader range of people, or is that not something that we usually do? I know that we're not usually doing that, but.
Well, I think that, for example, some of the national standard setters have tried to reach out to preparers and really, really made an effort to try to get some responses for us on the use of D9, but it varies.
This is going to sound terrible, but I don't have any objection to putting it in update, but that's already read by the Cognizanti, and I'm not sure how much more putting it there would. I'd be happy to pursue other mains, but I don't know how much more outlook would
you have enough
update. Information. I mean, would get for us, Joanna.
I guess, Thomas, you asked for comments on 11B and 11C, but I'm asking at a higher level, perhaps more in line with what Bernd was asking, as to, I think we need to be really clear what our objective is here. It strikes me with what you're bringing to us that you're bringing us a revised D9 and we are going to issue a revised D9. I didn't think that was where we had got to at all. I thought it was, hang on a minute, we've got a whole load, we issued that, the ISB didn't do something, we got this other query. Can you bring it back to us and say, should we do something further? And I see we've sort of jumped that, should we do something further, step into, we're doing something further and this is what it is. So I think be really clear, because I'm not sure, and it comes back to that outreach, as to whether actually this is a prevalent issue anymore. Is it a big deal if everyone's following D9, whether or not it was issued, then do we actually need to do anything? Is there any diversity? Are there any issues for us? And I'm not sure whether there actually are or not. So I guess I'm asking the question and expressing a view that we need to be careful about jumping to the end game before we've actually assessed whether or not it's something we want to do.
And I certainly, that's always a legitimate point, Joanna. The only thing I would add, though, is that it may not be a practice issue for people who adopted in 05, but for people who are first-time adopters in 10, 11, 12, 13, who don't have the benefit of that experience, it may be a practice issue, and we've got to be cognizant of those.
But if no one's raised it.
Well, they have, because
they have raised it,
not just in the submission that we received, but also through the agenda consultation, we heard from a number of places that people are concerned about this area and the gap that's in the literature here.
And I think that it should also be noted that although people didn't like the proposals in the discussion papers, they still thought that something should be done about the most difficult plans. And I think that we can also say we have some confirmation of divergence in practice. Some companies are using the D9 approach, while others are using the defined benefit obligation account. So I think we have some divergence in practice.
I think Joanna's point is that we do need to not presume that we're going directly to an end game. We have to build the case for it.
Yes.
And once we've done that,
that's fine.
Some of us think we've already done it, but we need to make sure we close that off, and that's a valid point. Florence?
I confirm that there is an issue out there that is not yet addressed about how to account for contribution-based promises. I know jurisdictions not far from my jurisdictions where D9 is applied quite widely by companies. I know another one which is not too that far as well from my jurisdictions where they apply the more DBO approach, so there is diversity. And if I recollect at the May meeting, when we were discussing whether changes were introduced by IS-19 revised, we did also receive already some submissions Wasn't there a Swedish submission that was mentioning contribution-based promises as being an issue? I can tell you, in Europe, I know at least five jurisdictions who are affected. I know that cash balance plans in the US is an issue, which is contribution-based promises, and for which there is no satisfactory solution either. So, and I know that this was being discussed at the discussion paper prior to the revisions to AS19 revised, where they come up with new proposals, and many comments were received, as you highlighted it in your paper. So, yes, there are various plans, contribution-based plans, and how to account for them remains problematic.
Fei Long, I didn't want to forget you. Did you want to come in on this topic?
No, I'm not good at that. So,
okay. John, you want to go ahead?
Then I would move on to paper 11C. Paper 11C deals with the scope and measurement of D9 plans. The committee had started redeliberating D9 in 2005 before it paused its work on then and in the end referred it to the board in 2006. And the staff had brought proposals on clarification on scope and changes to the measurement approach in D9 to the committee in 2005, but the committee had not made any tentative decisions on that issue when it stopped work on D9. On scope of D9, some respondents seem to think that the scope of D9 implied a direct connection between the contribution made and the return of on those contributions. Staff also thinks that it should be clarified that the return on the contribution does not need to be linked to a return on specific assets, and therefore we are proposing in paper 11C in paragraph 14 to slightly revise the scope of D9 if it were to be re-exposed. We are also suggesting that it should be clarified that the scope of D9 should include not only post-retirement benefits but also other long-term benefits. So that is the question to the committee, whether it agrees with this revision of scope. And
that's assuming we've satisfied Joanna's test in the first place. So. Andrew, and then Laurence.
Well, I guess my instinctive reaction to reading the paper was that we potentially seem to be broadening the scope out to deal with a number of complex variations, and I don't know whether the staff would agree with that or they actually think they're trying to narrow the scope, because it seems to me the key issue is we're trying to work out how to deal with schemes that would be defined contribution schemes but for the existence of a guarantee.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we can deal with that can we not just deal with that simple issue rather than broadening out to all these sort of bells and whistles and variations on it, or are you suggesting we need to do that in order to answer the basic question?
Well, I think that although definition in D9 originally was maybe not very complicated, people seem to think that it was not capturing certain types of plans. So I think that we need some clarification on that. So I'm based on it is just based on the respondent responses to the draft interpretation that people seem to be uncertain whether some plans which had all these characteristics were included within D9 or not.
I might be wrong, but isn't that where D9 fell down in terms of debates over scope? It seems to me that if we could just answer that basic question, then you could use the answer to that question to deal with a number of these other situations without having to go through the agony of dealing with them in an interpretation.
Let's do John, Laurence, and Joanna.
I mean, I share some of Andrew's concerns. It's hard to comment on scope without understanding what types of plans are actually going to be caught within scope and how the accounting is therefore going to be different. But I'm concerned about whether this is going to run into the same problem as in 2005 in terms of the breadth and myriad of different arrangements that will actually fall under this. It seems to me that some testing of this against what's out there, what types of plans do we think this would change the accounting for, would be very beneficial in understanding whether we've opened too broad a scope or we're dealing with a narrow issue. My view would be to try and keep the issue narrower to where there's a real problem rather than opening up a broader range of plans to different accounting.
All right.
What was proposed at the time of the discussion paper, what is being proposed today. I understand that at the D9 stage, the scope was considered to be too narrow because it was relying only on returns on specific assets and so on. When at the DP stage, it was considered too broad, capturing plans such as care plans, flat benefit plans, for which people know how to come for them today, and they didn't want these to be captured. So I think I am fine with what you propose as a working assumption for moving forward, but to be reconsidered in terms of scope, to see whether we are capturing the plans we want to address and we are not extending too much the scope and would be capturing plans we don't want to capture. As I said, I think we don't want to capture the care plans, the flat benefit plans. We don't want to revisit the definition between defined contribution plans versus defined benefit plans. I know that it was mentioned it's those type of plans that would be defined contribution plans in nature, except that for that guarantee. But in many cases, when you have such a plan, you may also add up a death or disability benefit that comes into it, which would make it no longer just a defined contribution plan with that guarantee, but still we would like to treat them under the scope. So my proposal, when I read, because also when criticism of D9 was to say it didn't focus on whether the employer has a legal constructive obligation to pay further contributions. This is an addition you're making to the scope. So I think it's probably it should be used as a working assumption, but to be revisited to ensure that we do not capture too many things. On drafting, there was just one thing. Not being a native English speaker, it's the first time I'm seeing investable and non-investable assets. So I was just curious to know whether what it was the English language. I was not familiar. I can understand what it means.
That comes under the heading of one that I suspect is equally confusing to native English speakers. I would, before bringing in others, I see Peter Clark in the audience, and he'll jump up and throw something at me if I get this wrong. My recollection of our original efforts in this area was that they ran up against at least two problems. One was scope creep. All of a sudden, we thought our initial scope was, I think, as Andrew described it. It was something that would be a defined contribution plan, but for one thing. And the difficulty was, it was all of a sudden, well, what about but for two things, or but for three things? And what about similar plans that, as Laurence has said, nobody's ever perceived to be a problem, like career average plans and things like that. The other part was measurement. And there were some clear parts about measurement. Peter, is that a reasonably accurate summation? He's nodding his head, yes, I won one. But let's go to Scott and then Joanna.
On the scope, I have to admit that when I read about the increase in scope due to the comments that John had suggested, I got to admit I thought all those additional plans should have already been covered in the original scope. So I kind of thought that, you know, if you promise to return based on inflation or anything else, I thought that should have been in the original scope anyways. Now, granted, I might have been involved in a few of the discussions back then, but I don't remember them, so I don't know what we were thinking at the time, but certainly reading it now, I thought, we ought to pick those up. So I think I'm okay with the scope suggestion that is made in the paper, although as we discuss things, we may realize that it's not quite as clear or as easy as it seems to be. I don't know if we want to go into to talk about measurement as well, but that's one of the things you asked for in the paper, is suggestions on where to go with measurement. I was trying to go back to IAS 19 and try to figure out what 19 is telling us is the goal of measuring a defined benefit obligation. And I don't think the goal is fair value, which gave me pause with relation to the comments that suggested that we ought to be able to try to take into account the time value of the guarantee and not just the intrinsic value. Taking into account time value to me seems like what you do if you're shooting for a fair value measurement, but not if you're shooting for an accrual based measurement. I'm not sure how to describe the measurement that IAS 19 prescribes, but it didn't seem like fair value to me, so I would shy away from measurement methodologies that tried to take into account the time value of this guarantee.
Joanna?
A similar comment. I am concerned that increase in the scope. So, and first of all, I apologise. I didn't call you John anyway. Apologies, John. I am worried that we are getting, so just be careful that we're not getting too broad with the scope. Certainly when you look at paper 11A, and to me, the comments that seem to be coming through were that because we were not clear enough about what the scope was, as opposed to the scope wasn't wide enough, in that what did it actually mean? And so to me, particularly what you've written in paragraph 11 of paper 11A, in terms of what we actually haven't, you know, the plans intended to be covered by, have a return guaranteed by the employer, thereby exposing the employer to additional risk. If that's what we meant to say but didn't, and therefore created all the confusion, then to me, that's what we need to do this time, but don't expand it to include all sorts of other things. And even so far as, you know, your very last comment about, oh, by the way, we also intend to include other long-term benefits, not just retirement benefits. Now, I can't say no to that, but I do beg the question, why? We're talking about a defined contributions, you know, defined contribution and defined benefit schemes. And so it's just, again, just be careful that we're not doing scope creep. Yeah. To answer your question.
But that was just to be consistent with IAS 19.
But
yeah, I think, okay. Can we take Laurence's suggestion that we're doing this as a working principle?
Yeah.
It's a basis for moving forward. But,
but just
we'll
be careful.
Guido?
Well, when I look at the comments that were made to D9, and John pointed out that in paragraph 13 of 11A, the comments were that a number of plans are out there where the return is not linked to specific assets, all the assets which the plan is funded with, for instance, inflation equity index. So that seems to me that this contribution-based promises, for me, always have two characteristics. One is there's something out there that it might be the assets, it might be an equity index, might be something, you know, that floats and where there is no guarantee from the employer. And the other part is that there is a guarantee from the employer, which might be fixed, which also might be variable. Now, the comments seem to relate, if I'm reading 13 in 11A correctly, seem to relate to this floating variable part that is not guaranteed. Whereas our definition in 11C14, B, this guarantee that we are adding there seems to be the, that's a guarantee, that's the second part of these plans, where the guarantee might be linked to something else than a return of the assets. So aren't we talking about two different things here? The comment letters seem to relate to, the, in, you know, in my description, to the first part, where you have this floating part which might be related to the assets, might be to something else. And the second part is the guarantee might be related to, you could say, well, it's 2% or whatever of, so I'm a little bit confused. Are we really addressing the comments that were made to D9, or are we talking about something else?
I think that the confusion was that whether the return on the contribution, where the return on the contribution is based on something like an index or corporate measure or something like that. The return on the contribution, not on the assets.
Okay, but that would be, I could set up a plan and saying, okay, what you are getting is based on Euro Stoxx 50 or whatever, an equity index. So, but that's only one part. That would be a defined contribution plan if there is not a guarantee part. So what my understanding is that 14B says that also the guarantee given by the employer could be based on an underlying that is investable or non-investable.
Yeah.
But
Guido, you said on the first part, the promise would be a return based on a certain return on the contributions. So how would that not be a guarantee from the employer?
If the plan required you to invest in the Euro Stoxx 50. So if the plan said you will invest in the component parts of this index.
So it needs to be invested on that
basis.
Well,
maybe I should have said that we need to distinguish between funded and unfunded plans.
Yeah.
Which is not.
Okay, that complicates it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem with extending the scope to plans where, and it might be funded, because you have investable and non-investable assets in 14B, so it might also be funded plan under this principle.
So just taking that thought one step further, then what we'd be saying is that the employees get the actual return on the assets. That's the only way you could have that without there being a guarantee.
Yeah.
And then it wouldn't matter whether what index was specified, it's whatever the actual return was.
If it's unfunded, I agree with you. The whole thing is then guaranteed.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Well, I think that part of the confusion comes from the wording in D9, where it says that a promised return is either a guaranteed return on fixed asset, on a fixed amount or a rate, or a promise of variable return based on specific assets or indices. And people seem to come to the conclusion that if this index linking was not on a specific asset, that the plans would not fall in with the scope of D9. So if you have inflation linked to inflation or something like that, they would not fall within the scope of D9. So that's what we're trying to clarify.
I didn't see any disagreement to taking Jan's recommendation as a working principle. and we'll obviously circle back to it. I saw a lot of people say, here be dragons, so let's watch out for scope creep.
Finally,
you want to move on to the measurement then?
Finally, we have presented in the reminder of paper 11C and in the appendix proposals which the staff presented to, or measurement approaches which the staff presented to the committee in 2005. We are currently analyzing this work, and like I said earlier, we are planning to bring proposals on this issue to the next committee meeting, but we would however welcome any input by the committee on those, on this issue.
Anything specific on measurement that somebody wants to raise? Laurent?
John, when I read the appendix to agenda paper 11C, even if you know, I tried really to get into the issue, I know it's a complex one. When I went to the four approaches, I couldn't figure out what the approaches were doing. But this fixed variable, the modified fixed variable, the pure deconstruction approach and the modified pure deconstruction approach, if you ask me to summarize simply which what they are doing, I'm just unable to tell you. It's too complex for me to understand, so, and to have a view about whether I agree or not with any of the approach. In addition, I would need to have some illustration with cases to see what would be the effect of each approach. What I can say about the measurement, or some thinking about where I'd like to see work to be done. We have an IS-19 currently with a project unit credit method that is being applied quite readily, and we would like it to continue to be applied. We are not asking for a fundamental revision of IS-19 at this stage. So think that perhaps work needs to be done to see the extent to which this method can be applied to such contribution-based plans, and where this method does not work well, why? I think that depending on the type of guarantee that is given, is the guarantee something that you can project for the future, in which case I think that if you can make projections for the future, I don't see why you couldn't apply the IS-19 approach and doing your normal DBO calculation. Where I see that there might be a problem applying the IS-19 approach is where you are unable to make projections. And when are you unable to make projections? It's when you have, in effect, guarantees that rely on the future value of a financial instrument. Because nobody can project the future value of equity, of an equity instrument or whatsoever. So in that case, the DBO calculate, the project unit credit method cannot work. So, and in those cases, that's where in those cases you need something different to work on. And picking up on the case that Andrew was saying, if I just have a defined contribution plan, but for this guarantee, which is more of a financial nature, what do I want to really see in the financial statements? Yes, I want to show that it's not a complete defined contribution plan, so I need to have something. But really, what do I want to see in the financial statements? I want to see the payments I might be able to be making because of that financial guarantee, in which case it would just be accounting for the nets. The criticisms, as I understand them, previously, and particularly the discussion paper stage, is that previously it was requiring applying the IS-19 approach to the full amount of the plan rather than just to the guarantee. And here, if we were just, you know, to focus on Do we just have to measure that guarantee and then this is what we would book versus the ones we can encompass into the calculation of the DBO because issue, it's a simple scenario. It's a single scenario I can project versus those I cannot project, which I would measure then differently. That's some types of suggestion for work.
Let me see if I can rephrase what you said and if you agree with it. We need some worked examples. We need them under a common set of assumptions. So fixed set of assumptions, let's run these different approaches against them. And we need, I think, to see not just the current period, but again, under a fixed set of assumptions, how would expense recognition look like over an extended period of time? So we can see a pattern there too. I think we need all of those things, and then we'll decide whether or not we need to say, all right, what if we change this assumption a little bit? What if we, so you got an Excel spreadsheet problem ahead of you.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think that's what Laurence is asking for. Would others agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think that's what we'll do then, okay. Or not what we will do. You will.
Yeah, a couple of additional comments. Obviously, when we'll be looking at the measurement, looking at P&L effect and so on, the expense effect, there will be that issue we will run into about the allocation of whatever we put on the balance sheet, which will remain a big issue. Do you spread? Don't you spread? Do you recognize immediately? Does it go to OCI? To OCI? Is it change in measurements? Is it P&L immediately? You are going to run into those issues that are complex. But
I think that's what I. Yeah. I hope we can start simple.
Yeah.
But others? Guido?
If I understood correctly, these four, or at least three of the measurement examples were also discussed during the discussion of D9 at the term. And my understanding is I'm wrong because John was...
these four approaches were presented in the redeliberations of D9. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So... basically, we're just presenting you with what was discussed then, because we were not in a position to bring something to you.
Yeah, the D9 was based on the variable fixed approach, and if I see the reactions from the comments, seems to be that the majority was okay with it. There was a minority that had three issues that should be discussed. That's in 11A. So,
yeah, and one of the problems with it would be very difficult to work with it on the more complicated plans.
I was saying, because if I have a fixed variable, then I think this fixed variable distinction only works if you have a guarantee of a rate or an amount. And all others would fall into its only variable, and if my understanding is correct, we would value it at, well, let's say, the fair value of the underlying assets at a certain point of time without recognizing the time value.
Yeah.
Very simple approach. Sounds convincing to me as well.
Okay. Do you have what you need?
Yep.
This time I think we actually all agree on what he needs.